Amen. Many of us often go through life seeking perfection and finding it so frustrating when everything constantly blows up in our face. We come up with what we think is the perfect plan, and then the perfect plan doesn't work out. Well, I'm sure that this is how many of the children of Egypt felt after, or children of Israel felt after going down to Egypt. We remember the story. We talked about it last week, but we have this man named Jacob, and he had a son, and his son began as a slave in Egypt, and he rose to become number two in authority over the land, over the nation, second only to Pharaoh himself. And due to the gratefulness of the Pharaoh toward Joseph for all that he had done to save the nation, he invited his family, Joseph's family, to come and live there, and he gave them the best of the land. And we saw in this whole event the promise of that God made to Abraham being fulfilled, that they would multiply and become a great nation, and the nations of the world, all the nations of the world, would be blessed through them. And certainly Egypt experienced the blessing of God upon them because they welcomed these children of Israel into their midst. But times had changed between then and the opening verses of the book of Exodus. The Hebrew population was growing rapidly, and this created a crisis for Pharaoh, and he decided that he would put in different measures in order to stop the growth of the nation. And so first of all, he thought that he might tamp down the growing population by enslaving them. And as we reflected last time, we showed some ancient Egyptian documents which gave you a picture of just how terrible it would have been to be a slave at that time under Egyptian rule. Perhaps they thought that if they treated the children of Israel cruelly, many of the men might have died just naturally as a result of the bitter work that they were made to undergo. And then also perhaps families would have decided, you know, we don't want to bring children into this crazy world that we're living. Yet in spite of all of that, Israel continued to grow. God continued to prosper them. God continued to fulfill his covenant toward them. They continued to multiply. And so he thought, well, maybe what he would do is he would bring a halt to the growth of the population by enlisting what were probably Hebrew midwives. We can't say that definitively, but what were probably Hebrew midwives. And the idea was that when it was time for a Hebrew woman to give birth, the midwife would be right there, and if it was a boy, she was to kill the boy. But we know the story. We reflected upon it last week that the midwives didn't go along with that particular approach, so that plan B failed. And so this week we turn to plan C, and this is Pharaoh's last and most vile attempt to destroy Israel's growth. And we notice it listed in 1:22. It says, "Then Pharaoh commanded all his people." Notice, he commanded all of his people. "Every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast him into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." So what is the thinking behind that? Well, probably what he would like is that all the Hebrew babies, boys to be killed, the daughters would live, and then they would be assimilated into the wider Egyptian culture through marriage. And so in this way, he would now destroy the culture, Hebrew culture, and at the same time, he could keep them within the fold. So why is it that he would want them to be thrown into the Nile? Well, number one, there aren't a lot of other bodies of water in Egypt. That is the main one. But the main reason why the Nile, and not just any old body of water, is because the Nile was believed to be a god. And so they believed that scholars believe that this was what would be called a trial by ordeal. In fact, if an Egyptian were to snatch a Hebrew baby and throw him into the Nile River and the Hebrew baby were to die, well, it's not their fault that he died. It was the judgment of the Nile god upon the baby. And so because the Nile God is a living entity, a god, it would be really the judgment of the gods against that little child. And so in that way, they could absolve themselves of the guilt of participating in such a heinous act. This whole story, as we kind of take a look at it, we're looking at it from a bird's eye view. It kind of reminds me of Joseph Stalin's famous words. He said this: if only one man dies of hunger, that is a tragedy. If millions die, that's only statistics. And if you know the story of Joseph Stalin, you know that he starved probably millions of people. Just statistics. And sometimes when we read things like this, we can't comprehend the carnage. And so this story telescopes into one particular family, and one particular family for reason. And that is because the deliverer of Israel will come from this particular family. There is a couple. Their names were Amram and Jochebed. They're not mentioned here, but we know their names from the larger story. And for them, these were the best of times and the worst of times. Reminds you of the opening of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, where he began by saying, the best of times, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness, it was the epic of belief, it was the epic of incredulity, it was a season of light, it was a season of darkness, it was the spring of hope, it was the winter of despair. And surely for this couple, this is what it was like, the best of times and the worst of times. We have to ask ourselves the question, what would it be like to live in a time, in a culture, in a place where government officials made the decision that your child must die? What would that be like? That's exactly what these people were grappling with at that time. This is something that shouldn't be too foreign from our thinking. Thankfully, we don't live in a country that makes pronouncements like that, but there are countries in the world that do and have, and not so long ago. In fact, some of them are currently practicing these things. Robert Malthus wrote a book in 1798, and it was entitled An Essay on the Principle of Population. 1798. And from that book came something called Malthusian theory. How many have heard of Malthusianism or Malthusian theory? Not just a couple of hands. Well, you will hear it in its other form. Actually, believe it or not, he was a member of the clergy. It's shocking to think of that, but he was. But he believed that the growth of the population was far exceeding the ability for modern societies to produce food. And if we do not curtail the growth of humanity, soon we're going to run out of food and it's going to be mass starvation everywhere. It's a problem of overpopulation. Have you heard anybody say to you that a real problem today is a problem of overpopulation? Well, this theory has been debunked by economists time and time again, not only just by economists, but by history itself, since that work was published. But it is widely believed that we have a problem with overpopulation. In fact, it's led to all kinds, this way of thinking has led to all kinds of human calamities over the centuries since the book was written. For instance, in the 1840s, there was the Irish potato famine. And during the Irish potato famine, officials in England let untold scores of people in Ireland starve to death, justifying it by Malthusian theory. In fact, this is what they called it. They called it the effective mechanism. This is the potato famine where people were starving and they could have helped them. They called it the effective mechanism for reducing surplus population. In fact, by letting the Irish starve, they believed that they were saving the world. Malthusian theory. It's a common idea. I went recently, bought a car. Our car died. We had to get another car. And the guy selling me the car, he said, you know, the real problem with the world is overpopulation. And we have to do something to limit the number of children that are born, or else everything is going to be in trouble. We noticed this in China, for instance. I believe in 1979, they enacted the one-child policy. But this has been such a disaster that in 2015, they moved to a two-child policy because they realize now that they do not have a population of youth to support this aging population. And now they've increased it to a three-child policy. And recently, this was a 2021, they've been debating just removing all restrictions whatsoever because they realize that they are on the verge of societal collapse and catastrophe. You have tens of millions of boys in China who have no hope for marriage. As a result of that, they have had to bring in countless women from countries around China, promising that they will be brides of these men, only to enlist them in human trafficking, destroying these women's lives. It is a problem of epic proportions, and it's predicated on a long debunked notion that the earth is overpopulated. There's a couple of things that we can make note of when we think about this idea of overpopulation. It's the same kinds of lies that Pharaoh was telling himself. We're telling ourselves now, you know, we're going to be in trouble if we let the children of Israel continue to grow. It's going to destroy us. It's going to wreck us. We got to do that. We got to do something. Maybe we got to kill them. What's amazing that a theory like that could survive when we pay millions, billions of years to farmers not to grow food? Or if you were to just get in your car and you were to drive from here to Chicago, which we've done many times, you will find that there are very few areas in between here and Chicago that are occupied by any people at all. Overpopulation isn't a problem, but it's something that those who live in cities, who are used to living on top of one another, are quick to believe because that is their experience, but that isn't the reality. The things that they see have deceived them, and these things are just not the way that they seem to be. And so we live in a world where this kind of thinking predominates, and so we can understand how perhaps a culture thousands of years ago would have had the same kinds of concepts in mind. If we're going to survive, if there's going to be enough food to go around, we have to obviously eliminate the people that are causing problems. We have overpopulation. You can imagine now, as we look at the story of this family, it must have been the best of times, and with the idea that here you have this young couple. They have at least a couple of other kids, but now they find out that there's another one on the way, and how excited they must have been the moment they discovered that they had a child. But then how devastating of a thought it was when they thought to themselves, well, what if it's a boy? You can imagine the prayers. Oh Lord, don't give us a boy. Please don't give us a boy. Give us a girl. Lord, don't put us in that position. Keep us from that situation. We don't want to have that moral dilemma. Lord, just give us a girl. We plead with you. We beg you. You can imagine day after day, as the months began to roll by, as they thought about their particular situation. And then the contractions start. And you can imagine the emotion. What's going to happen? What is this child going to be? And then as soon as the baby is born, they say, is it a girl? Is it a girl? And then they hear the words, nope, it's a boy. And in one moment, here you have this mother who's elated, and at the other moment, she is devastated. Can you imagine what it would be like to be in a situation like that? You can imagine the questions, oh God, why would you allow this? We love you, we serve you, and now we're in this position. Maybe you've been in that situation in your life where you've faced moral dilemmas and you cried out, oh God, why did you allow this to happen to us? How could this be? We're just trying to be faithful to you. We have no control over what's happening. And then perhaps a sense of peace came over them, particularly over Jochebed, the baby's mother. She noticed that he was a fine child, and the word there for fine child is just the basic Hebrew word for good. And it's a word that can refer to physical appearance. Like for David and Saul, it called them good. They were definitely good-looking guys. But you know, you think about it in a sense of every mother. No matter how ugly that baby might be, when she looks at that baby, she says, oh, that is a good-looking baby, right? You ever hear it's a face that only a mother could love? Ever hear that expression? But there's another sense where it could refer to something more than that. It could have a theological component to it. A special God-given quality. Acts 7:20, in Stephen's speech, he mentions this. He says, at that time, Moses was born a beautiful child in God's eyes. His parents cared for him at home for 3 months. You have this picture of this beautiful child. And so they doubled down to do whatever they could to save his life. I'm sure that they tried to do everything perfectly right to keep him hidden. For the first 3 months, they hid him. And you know that there's few things more cute than a three-month-old baby, right? I mean, I love the three-month stage. You can put them right there in your arm. They're like the size of a football. They can't run away. They just want to be there. They look up at you. It's just the sweetest, it's one of the sweetest ages for a child. And here they are. They're at this stage, and they can't hide him. It's at this stage. Here's a picture of a three-month-old baby. He raises his head and chest when he's on his stomach. He opens and shuts his hands. He swipes at dangling objects. He watches faces intently. He recognizes now objects and people. He smiles at familiar voices. He begins to imitate sounds. He even develops a social smile. And these things are all according to the American Pediatric Association. So it just seems so strange what it must have been like after 3 months. They decide to send him down the river, as they say, right? That's how a lot of people think of the story. A lot of people think of the story as Amram and Jochebed. They made this little boat. The word for basket, actually, Moses chose this word when he wrote this. It's actually the same word for ark. It would have been nice if the translators might have translated it that way. But we know that they obtained, or they either made it or procured this little ark of a basket boat. And sometimes as we think about the story, they just kind of dutifully gather the family together. You know, it's been really nice having Moses here for 3 months. And he's been a really good baby. And when we looked into his eyes, we knew there was something special about him. But we can't hide him anymore. The Egyptians are coming around. They're liable to catch him. So why don't we just do the job ourselves? So they took Moses, they stuck him in this basket, ark, and they sent him down the river. See you, son. It's been good getting to know you. Have a good trip. You think that's how it happened? No, I think you could tell. That telling of the story reminds me of when I was a kid, my mother found a duck, and we had all kinds of animals at our house, and the duck had a broken leg, and my mother's a softie for things like that, so we brought this little tiny duck in, and she made a stent for the leg of the duck, and the duck eventually healed and was getting better. And I don't remember the duck's name, but we'll just call him Freddy. So Freddy just was this cute little duck. We loved the duck. He was fun to be around. I couldn't wait every day after school, 6, 7, or 8 years old, just to play with the little duck. And then it was time. We had a lake near our house. It was time to put the duck back in the water. So we all went down by the shore side. We had little Freddy. Freddy, it's time to go back to your home. Put little Freddy in the water. Freddy's swimming along, happily swimming along. And then all of a sudden, this giant snapping turtle comes out of the water, whoosh, brought him down, and I was never the same since. No, that was the end of Freddy. That's kind of the image you get of this story. They put their son in this little basket boat, and they sent him down the river and said, sayonara. We'll see you next time. No, that's not what happened. The story is very clear about it. That is not what these parents did. But that's sometimes how we think about the story. But if we look at the details, we notice that it's something very different comes up. There are lots of moral questions surrounding this, right? How can godly people kill their own son? How can they send him up the river? And the simple answer to this question is that's not what they were doing at all. Amram and Jochebed put their baby boy into the river, not to kill him, but to save him. And this was a situation where their child was in danger. And you know, if you've been in a situation like that, maybe when you were a kid, you were in a situation when you were in danger, and somebody did something to save you, but it meant it cost them. Maybe you were in an accident, and you were springing up toward the windshield of the car, and they reached their hand out and knocked you down, and then maybe they hit the windshield for you. Maybe you did that for somebody else. It is this instinctive thing that we do for others that we love. We will do just about anything we can to save them, and they hatched a plan. They hatched what appeared to be a perfect plan. But there's one thing that we should mention before we get into some of these details, and it is this. God has the power to make a way when no way seems possible. God has the power to make a way when no way seems possible. We're given three details that gives us clues behind the real story within the story. Number one, they hatched a perfect plan. They hatched a perfect plan. Moses' parents hid the boy in plain sight. Now, when we think about babies, it's interesting that they picked this 3-month stage for this, because babies cry the most between 6 and 8 weeks. And actually by 3 months, they're crying less. But if you're familiar with little babies, you know that there's a different quality of the cry between those younger stages and then a little bit older. You know, when you have this little baby and the baby's born and the baby's crying, and it's almost like the soft muffle, right? And all of a sudden the baby's crying. Everybody wants to hold the baby. Oh, hold the baby. And I'll say, oh, you're just a cute little baby. You'll be fine. All of a sudden the baby just stops. Maybe the lip is quivering, but the baby stops crying. And oh, it's such a cute thing, this little crying baby. But when they're at 3 months and they're crying, guess what they do? Say, where's the mother? Because they're not just crying, they're yelling at 3 months. It's really hard to hide a crying baby at 3 months. And so they had to figure out what to do with him. This is probably one of the reasons why they chose this particular age. It's harder to probably conceal him under clothes or whatever else. He's probably more squirmy at this point. And so what they did was they made the perfect little boat. I've described it a little bit, but just say a little bit more about it. It's translated here, basket. We know it was an ark. It was covered with bitumen, that's asphalt, and tar, or pitch. So it was this hard substance. It became like concrete. You can imagine, we have asphalt all over the place around here. And so they had this floating little ark. It was covered with this hard substance. They put him in a perfect location. If we look closely in verse 3, it says they placed it among reeds by the riverbank. What does that tell you? They didn't just walk up to the side of the river and say, send him down the river and say, see ya. No, they actually found a place where there were reeds growing up. It was right next to the bank, and they hid him in there, probably camouflaged. You probably couldn't see it from the ground because the young ladies who were attending the princess did not discover it as they were walking by, as we will see in a little bit. Probably also this area was free of crocodiles, because this is a place that the royals would have gone. So certainly they wouldn't have, the Pharaoh wouldn't have let her daughter go to a place where there were crocodiles. And the timing that they had was probably perfect. The thought is that there were probably enforcers who would go intermittently throughout the Hebrew camp looking for children, and they weren't there all the time. But perhaps the idea is that when they would be going through the village, there would be kind of a system in place that people who were desperate have, where they would have told each other, and perhaps at those moments they would have taken the little baby, they would have put him in that little ark, they would have put him among the reeds, and they had the perfect person there. We have Miriam, probably Miriam. It doesn't say it's Miriam. More than likely it was Miriam, and she was at the right age where she could watch at a distance. She wasn't too young where she couldn't help. But she wasn't so old that somebody would say, why is she hanging around the riverside and not working in a kitchen or not working in a field? She was small enough where she could get away with it. So she was the one who was watching in the situation. I mean, the parents came up with a plan from every angle which seemed absolutely perfect for preserving their child. If this group is like most groups, I bet we have a lot of perfectionists here. You probably see this and you can relate really well to what these parents did. But you know the biggest thing that frustrates perfectionists? Nothing stays perfect, does it? It makes life very difficult when we're always seeking after perfection, but we never get there, we never find it. And that's exactly what happened here. The perfect plan that was hatched is foiled. Suddenly, there's a princess who went down to the river to bathe, probably ritual bathing, probably not a regular place where they bathe, but something akin to Hindus when they go to the Ganges River to bathe. And so she went down to the river to bathe, and she saw the basket, it says, among the reeds. So somehow she caught a glimpse of it. The last person in the world that the family would have wanted to find that basket, you would think, would have been the daughter of the person who gave the command to kill all the Hebrew boys. I mean, if there was anybody who must have thought hated them for just being Hebrew, it was the royal family. Yet this is what happens. And so when it was brought to her, she opened it up and noticed that the little boy was crying. Now consider how Miriam's heart must have sank at that moment when she felt all that pressure as the big sister, and there was nothing she could do. She just had to watch. I don't know if you're one of those people with a vivid imagination. Maybe you don't like roller coasters. The reason you don't like roller coasters is because you can see disaster in your mind before it takes place. You see yourself going up in that roller coaster, and you are the first. You would be on the first car in history to kind of go down the track and up and then out into the wild blue yonder, right? Or you imagine yourself on the swing, and the swing is going around, and you imagine the whatever holds the swing to snap, and you just fly off into the sky. You ever think like that? Have that wild imagination. It goes in front of you. Well, if you are, don't feel bad. I'm one of those guys too. I got the wild imagination. It seems so vivid, it seems real. And you can imagine her in her mind's eye just imagining this princess picking up the baby boy and saying, oh, well, father says that they need to be thrown into the Nile, and so I need to just drop the baby in the water. And there would have been nothing that Miriam could have done in that situation. You can imagine the tension that would have fallen over this whole situation. And then God intervened. And then the impossible happened. It says in verse 6, she took pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. You see, when our perfect plans are foiled, we have one who can save the day. And that's exactly what happened next. Then God gave Miriam wisdom. She took control of the situation. She suggested that she find a nurse for her. And then the whole story hinges on this command from Pharaoh's daughter, and she said, go! I love that. God moved in when there was nothing else anyone else could do. God save the day. And you know, we see this in the most beautiful way in our salvation. This story tells the story of the gospel. How we were lost and dead in our trespasses and sins. A lot of us go through life trying to be perfect. A lot of us go through life thinking that our good deeds will outweigh our bad deeds, and because of that, that when God sees us on that final day, we'll be okay. But the reality is that God will not allow anything unrighteous into his presence. And so what do we do? Because we know that we've all sinned. What did he do? He sent his son, Jesus Christ, to be a sin offering for us. He took our place on the cross. He paid for our sin on the cross. And in exchange, gave us his righteousness so that through faith in him, we can have that righteousness. Through faith in him, we can have that new life. This is the most beautiful gift in all the world. In our own perfectionistic tendencies, we think that we can get there and we can work our way there on our own. But the reality is that there is no way for us. But in that moment, God rescued us. And this story foreshadows what Jesus did for us. As we see God interceding in that moment, it's amazing what he does. What he does in our lives after we come to him, how he changes our lives, how he gives us a whole new lease on life, how he gives us a reason to live. How he gives us joy even in painful and difficult circumstances. How he gives us peace when the whole world around us is in chaos. And in this case, what does he do? Miriam goes off. She finds her mother. Her mother gets to nurse little Moses. And in those days, a child could be 3 or 5 years old, up to 5 years old, before the weaning happened, which I can imagine in this case. I think that if I'm Moses' mom, I'm pushing that to the limit, right? And then she was paid to boot. I mean, can you imagine the jealousy from all the other Israelites? What in the world? You get to keep your baby, and you get paid to keep your baby, and he's going to go live in Pharaoh's household? Only God could do that. In the most desperate of circumstances, situations, only God could do that. And so we notice that eventually Pharaoh's daughter named him Moses because she said, I drew him out of the water. Just want to mention quickly three points of application. Number one, every detail in our lives is important to God. Every detail in our lives is important to God. Throughout this story, they thought that they could make everything perfect, but they couldn't. And God was working behind the scenes to bring about the end that he desired. We need to trust God with the details of our lives. When things don't work out the way that we want them to work out or the way that we plan them to work out, we have to trust that God has a bigger purpose in all of it. I remember when we lived in North Carolina, we lived there till I was 14, and when I was 14, we moved to Illinois. My older brother was 3 years older than me. He was a senior in high school. Halfway through his senior year, we had to move. He was not happy. I remember him begging and pleading with my mother, I can't move now, I can't move now. His main objection was, I kid you not, there are no pretty girls in Illinois. That was his objection. He could not go to Illinois because there were no pretty girls there. You know, the amazing thing was, we go to Illinois, and 4 or 5 months later, he meets a girl. She becomes his wife. They've been married for over 30 years. And never once since have I ever heard him complain that there are no pretty girls in Illinois. God is working behind the scenes of our lives to bring about eventualities that our minds cannot even conceive of now. We can try to plan and plot and do everything perfectly, but we live in an imperfect world. And he is a way of arranging things where he can make broken things beautiful. And that's what he does with our lives. Second thing is this. God calls us to do what is right and trust that he'll never fail. Sometimes in situations like this, when we find ourselves in moral dilemmas, we're prone to compromise because we think that we have the whole picture in front of us. I love that this family never compromised. They didn't put him in the river because they were following Pharaoh's decrees. They put him in the river simply to defy his decrees. It was just the best way to do it. And God had a purpose in all of that. And God took care of the rest. It doesn't always mean it's going to end up like it did with Amram and Jochebed. Doesn't mean that. But what it does mean is that God is a good God and he will always do what is right. And he calls us to do what's right when we find ourselves in those crossroads of life, and he will take care of the rest. And we can trust him. He's faithful in all of those things. And then finally, third, God often uses the most unlikely instruments to do his best work. Why does he do that? And by the way, sometimes it's easy to feel like an oddball, right? You ever feel like an oddball? We all feel like, I think, oddballs in certain situations and cases. But you know, the reason why God uses oddballs to do his greatest work is because it's undeniable who did it. So we read in 1 Corinthians, verse 26 and following, it says, "For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you are wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God." You see, when God uses oddballs, that brings him glory. I love how I.M. Haldeman put it. He's actually a pastor, and when he was very young, he fought in the Civil War, so he wrote this a long time ago. But he wrote this. He said, "The life of Moses presents a series of striking antitheses. He was a child of a slave, the son of a queen. He was born in a hut and lived in a palace. He inherited poverty and enjoyed unlimited wealth. He was the leader of armies and the keeper of flocks. He was the mightiest of warriors and the meekest of men. He was educated in the court and dwelt in the desert. He had the wisdom of Egypt and the faith of a child. He was fitted for the city and wandered in the wilderness. He was tempted with the pleasures of sin and endured the hardships of virtue. He had the rod of a shepherd and the power of the infinite. He was a fugitive from Pharaoh and an ambassador from heaven. He was the giver of the law and the forerunner of grace. He died alone on Mount Moab and appeared with Christ in Judea. No man assisted at his funeral, yet God buried him." It's a beautiful story of God's redemption. And it all foreshadows the true redemption that's found in Jesus. Perhaps there are some this morning who are here and you feel weighed down. Maybe you feel weighed down by sin. Maybe you feel like you're in bondage to sin. Maybe you feel as if there is no hope for you. The Lord's made a hope. He's made a way through his son Jesus. And when you find Jesus, you find true freedom. Do you know Jesus? He came to set you free. He came and made a way when there seemed to be no way possible. He died for us. Do you know him? Let's pray.